We've had a very sticky problem tonight. It's been worrying us for thousands of years. The question of whether we are tried more than we can actually bear. You know, according to the best theologians, we are never tried more than we are able to bear the trial. And the question has just been raised, how does this apply to a suicide? Has he been tried too much? Opposition. We start off in the circle to represent the tabula rasa of the scholastics, the man with the blank mind. This is a hypothetical individual coming into being for the first time, so that his mind is presumed to be a kind of blank sheet upon which anybody may write, and which the first stimulus entering finds no opposition whatever. Let's pretend for a moment this is a possibility. It isn't actually a possibility at all, but we will pretend that it is. Imagine a being who comes into the world with no internal form whatever. It's just a pure substance. The substance has only one power, the power that the biologists call irritability. And irritability means the ability to respond to a stimulus, to react to it, and to retain a trace of it, a memory trace, to retain a memory of both the incoming stimulus and its own reaction. And this is how the biologist uses the word irritability. Irritability means the power to react to an incoming stimulus and to retain the traces of the incoming stimulus and the traces of its own response. Now let's pretend that we have such a being whose record level is zero, like the number on the gate outside that's lost its one. And we have here simply this plain being, so that when a stimulus comes in, the stimulus enters into a zero characterized field. So there is no formal capacity to react at all. Let's call this the first level of testing. Now, when this first energy comes in, it enters a non-characterized field. That being so, there must be no resistance whatever to the incoming stimulus. Let's pretend for a moment that the incoming stimulus, the first one, is the first of the temporal series. We can call it, if you like, 1TS, first of the temporal series. Now, when it comes in, it is coming in to a being of zero characterization. That is a being that is formless on the inside. Consequently, the incoming stimulus cannot have a formal reaction. But the first temporal stimulus is its first temptation. Temptation simply means the presentation of temporal stimulation. So that when you are tempted, it merely means that in a given time, a situation is presented to you and you are to respond to it. And the mode of your response is your reply to the temptation. Now, if you have zero characterization, that is, you are formless, when the stimulus comes in, we'll pretend the stimulus is X. It just goes straight through the being and writes X within the being. Now, if this is so, this mysterious X, the experience form, cannot be evaluated at all because there is nothing to evaluate it against. It is the first formal presentation and it is coming into a formless being. Because the being is formless, it cannot judge at all. And consequently, the first stimulus simply writes its own name inside the being. So its first temptation is quite simply one that it meets innocently. The first dispensation is the dispensation of innocence. If you read the theological development in the Bible, you will find that Adam in the Garden of Eden prior to the fall is said to be in the dispensation of innocence, which means that when a stimulus comes to him for the first time, he cannot possibly know anything about it. Consequently, his reaction to it is nil. It simply means that the incoming stimulus writes its own name inside his protoplasm. So his first temptation he responds to innocently. Now, how about the second temptation? He hasn't judged on the first one because he had nothing to judge it with. The symbol of judgment, we've shown before, is simply a pair of scales, a balance. So in the first place, he has nothing in the pans at all. So he hasn't got a weight. So if we put X on one side suddenly, that's the incoming stimulus, it simply means that X weighs down the scale. The bones aren't tipped, the other one goes up. He can't help going up at all, because there's nothing to weigh against the X. So it responds to its first temptation by simply accepting it. This is what happened to Adam and Eve when the first temptation, whether they would eat of the tree of knowledge of good and evil, presented to Eve, she hasn't got a reason to refuse. After all, God didn't tell Eve not to eat it, he only told Adam. And as Adam happens to be Eve's husband, there's no reason at all why she should take any notice of what he has said. So consequently, she listens to the serpent, which means the external stimulus, and the external stimulus going in simply writes his name on her and says a threefold thing. This knowledge of good and evil is a fruit, good to look at, pleasant to eat, and conferring knowledge like the gods have. So she eats innocently. They've not yet been in trouble, so they haven't got anything to judge it by. And Adam does as his wife says, and then they're both in trouble. So the first temptation is simply the presentation of a stimulus into a state of formlessness. The formlessness cannot formally react, and therefore it simply accepts. So the response to the first stimulus is the acceptance, which is the letter Aleph, or the Greek Alpha. This is the infinitely formless, accepts any stimulus whatever. And therefore the first character is simply the character of the incoming stimulus. Now the statement is that a being has never tried more than it can stand, and when this first stimulus comes in, certainly the being is not being tried more than it can stand, because it assimilates the incoming energy. It simply becomes characterized by the incoming stimulus. Now let's pretend another stimulus comes this time, and it isn't X, this time it's Y. So now the incoming stimulus comes in, and it writes the letter Y inside the being. The being now looks at the X inside itself and at the incoming Y, and it can feel that X is not Y. Now at this point it has two forms, one that's been in for some time and that it has adjusted itself to, and a new one that it has not adjusted itself to in the same degree. But as it comes in, it can then evaluate where the new stimulus energy is either similar to or different from the first stimulus. You can see from the letter Y that it would fit the top part of the X quite nicely, vibrate with it, harmonize with it, but the descender on the Y would not fit the X. So we would say the being now would respond by saying this Y fits the top part of the X, and it does not fit the descender on the Y. So it now feels a peculiar form in the center, the descender of the Y, as a new thing. Now at this point it can, if it wills, say I don't like it and proceed to repress it, or it can say I do like it and proceed to try to enhance it, maintain it in existence. If we look at it, we find that this new descender, unlike the two top parts of the Y that correspond with the top part of the X, the new descender introduces another form of interest into the being. In fact, it gives a sort of three-fold mark upside down something like the mark of Cain or the mark of Her Majesty's purse bags and criminals, the three nails of the cross or the broad arrow. And then we can see that the introduction of this letter Y into the already engrammed X situation produces a possibility of a greater enrichment of form. And it introduces several new angles which we can examine and which produce new harmonics, new experiences. But the being is actually presented with an occasion of choice, because it can, if it wills, press on this Y and try to stop it vibrating, try to reduce it to its minimal form. It cannot eliminate it completely. It can reduce it to a very low level. Whether it does so is entirely within the will of this being. And because it's in the will of that being to either repress or to augment the vibration of the incoming stimulus, therefore, we talk about the responsibility of the being to make a choice in a situation where choosing is presented. Here then we see on the presentation of the second stimulus that the being, having experienced X and now experiencing Y, can choose to repress either the X or the Y, or to maintain them in equilibrium. Nothing can constrain it not to do either of these things, or force it to do one at the expense of the other. It can respond within the stimulus framework. So that in the second stage, it is no longer innocent, because it is characterized by the first stimulus. So it has some mental furniture to which it refers when it is making its choice. Viewed algebraically like this, it doesn't perhaps seem very concrete. But in fact, if we change X for one person and Y for another person, and call our original being A, A presented with X and Y, that is Albert presented with Xenophon and Yetta, the girl with the curly hair from the delicatessen shop, presented with both at once, will have a certain kind of complex response pattern. But here again we can see that the equation of choice is quite simple. This being is not being tested beyond its power to respond. It has got form within it, and it does know the form that it has, and it can evaluate the incoming stimulus with the stimuli it has already assimilated inside itself. So it is not being presented with a stimulus situation that it cannot react to adequately. Now, once we've understood this principle, we can see that no matter how many new stimuli we put in, we are always putting them into a being already characterized, which being has actually assimilated the first one innocently, and the next one, not quite innocently, but in a very simple judgment based on the comparison of two different stimuli, quite simple. Now, according to the way it chooses, so, at each level, it is presented with another choice. And the choice at each level is simply the resultant of all its previous responses to given situations. So that no matter how tense the situation may be, later on, when it is very fully characterized, the situation is still exactly the result of the series of choices made. And it is the inevitable result of those choices made, and consequently it cannot be said that something has been imposed upon it that it didn't ask for. This means that there is no injustice. A mysterious, omnipotent God behaving in an arbitrary manner and imposing tests on people that they shouldn't be subjected to is just not true. When a test is subjected, or a test is put on a subject, the subject has progressively put himself in the position to get precisely that test and not another, because he has in fact made the necessary choices beforehand to get there. Now, we had this the other day when a patient quarreled very bitterly about being put in a position of choice by his parents. And he said he had not done this himself. He had been put in the position of this choice, and it was unfair that he should have visited upon him the necessity of making this choice. And I said, let us look at a very simple diagram, because this particular man is an architect, and he draws plans and things. So I said, let us draw a circle and say that is any given human being. And we know that this human being, if it multiplies, must divide. So in order to have a child, it must cut itself. It may cut up a little bit, but a tiny little bit, or it may cut itself a big lot off. But it cuts some off. What we call the sex cells inside any being are simply portions of the original plasm, the protoplasm, and that being the living plasm, cut off specifically to exude to make a child. Now, before it is cut off, before this division into the somatic or body cells and the sex cells, the whole thing is one protoplasm. Now, if you remember that when the little worm in the lowly worm experiment was subjected to an electrical shock, and an electrical lamp was switched on, so that after repeated electric shocks and switching on of the lamp, the worm jumped when the lamp was switched on, even when there was no electric shock. Now, subsequently, the division of this worm and the progeny of this worm reacted in the same way that the original worm did. That is, after several generations, when you switched on the light, they all jumped. And why did they jump? Did they jump because they were individuals unjustly imposed on by their wicked jumping worm ancestor? No. In fact, each one of those worms was a tiny bit of the original protoplasm that had received the shock. It was not another worm, it was, in fact, the same protoplasm. It was the shocked protoplasm that had again jumped. Now, in exactly the same way, a whole human being, before the process of cell division within the egg is a whole egg with no divisions, and we say that it responds protopathically, that is, it feels in the original mode that life feels, utterly without discrimination. Prior to the wall being built inside the egg, it is responding totally, non-discriminatingly, that is, protopathically. And in so doing, it is reacting as if it were an innocent. But as soon as we get a form inside it, the form of the first wall, before the others have appeared, and it divides itself into many millions, on the appearance of the very first wall, if a stimulus is now inserted, it goes through the protoplasm, hits on the wall, and is reflected. And thus the stimulus is confined to half of the egg. And if it goes on dividing itself more and more, progressively, when a stimulus comes, it is confined to a smaller and smaller area. So in the process of this internal division, that is, in fact, the isolating of a stimulus to one particular point, and the relative freeing on the rest of the protoplasm from the reaction. Any given one of those cells can become a child of the next generation. But whatever it is still the same protoplasm of the so-called preceding generation. It is the same protoplasm. And at this point, no child can say to its parents, I should not have had this inflicted on me by them, as if in fact they were separate. They are not. This existing child, the existing protoplasmic masses in this room, are all simply the continuations of previously existing masses of protoplasm, and they are all engrammed, formally charged and emotively charged, by the experiences the same protoplasm has had in the previous generation. So there is then no conceivable excuse for any given generation pretending that it is suffering unjustly. there's a rather tricky problem raised in the New Testament where the rabbis say, trying to catch Christ, which sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? It's a trick question. They want to say to him, has this man sinned? If so, you are teaching Old Testament justice. He's a reincarnating soul, he has sinned in a previous existence, and now he is blind, and that is our Old Testament justice. Therefore, do not talk to us of forgiveness, that is, of injustice. On the other hand, if he says it was not this man who sinned, but his parents, then this man is paying the price for his parents, and it is still Old Testament law, because it says the sins of the fathers shall be upon the children to the third and fourth generation. So if he answers the question in either of the two ways they want him to, he will support the old dispensation. This he has no intention of doing, and therefore he says neither this man nor his parents caused this being born blind, but he was born blind that the works of God might be made manifest. What does that mean? That the works of God might be made manifest. Let's start with the biggest sphere we can conceive, the one that the theologians use to prove the existence of God. And we'll call this the big work of God. This is his magnum opus, the cosmic logos. This is the cosmic body of the Christ. And inside this cosmic body, again, there are divisions. In my Father's house are many mansions, so we'll have to draw many mansions inside it. Now here's the progressive inworking within the universe of God, that is a spiritual power, having circumscribed a great big sphere. Any subsequent working that he does is going to be inside the sphere. Now imagine that this sphere contains within itself, in perfect dynamic equilibrium, all the forms of all possible activities whatever, and all forms, therefore, of every conceivable individuality, whatever. Because an individual is simply a type of actuality. Individuals are actualities. That is, they are ways in which power is acting. And the characteristic form of any individual is simply the characteristic form or way in which he has acted and is acting. Now, one man is born blind in here, and the rabbis want to know, did he sin, or did this larger chunk of which he is a bit sin? Now the thing about their question, it reveals them not to go far enough back. They are thinking in a very short time scale about this man and his mother and father, possibly his grandmother and grandfather. But they're not thinking back out of the time process into eternity. And eternity, as we've said before, means the Hague Trinity, or threefold spiritual power. And the whole sphere of cosmic being is the work of God. And to manifest that whole sphere, there must be at least one of every possibility. There must be a blind man, and a crippled man, and a crazy man, and so on, within this universal sphere. Because without them, we can never comprehend all the possibilities of being. So if there is a blind man inside there, he is only blind in order that the works of the whole macrocosmic sphere may be made manifest. Manifest means made fast in order to be evaluated. You know that the root man means to evaluate, to count. Manifest means made fast in order to be evaluated. Now, this man is born blind, and by means of this blind man, all the other men round about can look at this blind man and meditate on the meaning of eyes. And perhaps he is Lazarus and he's dying. And he is an occasion whereby it is shown that death is not a final stage, because he can be lifted up. Did Lazarus sin that he died in this way? Was he saved from his sin? Or was the whole situation simply another necessity of manifesting the totality of cosmic possibilities? As soon as we allow that God is omniscient, we say he knows everything. And he doesn't only know good things, he knows rubbishy things too. He knows every conceivable aberration that ever infested a schizophrenic brain. But to him, they're not things that are wrong, they're all right. Everything he knows, including the silliest joke, is valid, not as a good thing, but as a good, bad thing. So if there's an apple going rotten, it isn't a rotten, rotten apple, it's a very good example of a rotten apple. And when we can understand that everything that does occur within the universe, the so-called good and the so-called bad, are all good, especially the bad ones, then we can understand what it means that any given thing, like a man being born blind, or another man smelling 4 days in the grave and annoying his relatives, in order that there can be a resurrection, when we can understand this, then we are raised to the level where temptation becomes for us just another means whereby we exercise ourselves more efficiently. We see that the original totopathic or formless state of a being is such that when a stimulus comes in, nothing happens except that the stimulus records itself. So that the innocent, that is the person with no formal knowledge at all, responds simply by accepting. But when the next stimulus comes in, he doesn't have to respond simply by accepting. He can respond by comparing the old stimulus, accepted in his innocency, with the new one. And as he chooses to superstress one or the other, or to equilibrate both, or try to repress both, so he moves on to his next stage of development. But at each stage, he is presented with a concrete situation in the time process. And this concrete situation in the time process is called a temptation. Called a temptation because tempt means time. When we come into the situation and we see the man born blind or anything whatever that we don't like, we have to evaluate it against the existing forms within us, or we have to refuse to evaluate it. And we can refuse to evaluate it either negatively, that is in a repressive manner, and create a neurosis for ourselves, or we can say, I refuse to evaluate it seriously at all, I have not sufficient data to evaluate it properly, but I comprehend that ultimately it must be evaluated within the whole sphere of universal actualities. And when we go into it at the universal level, we say we accept the thing, no matter how bad it is. Now, if we learn the lesson of this, we find any given individual who is just a little snippet of the super individual, the cosmic being, any little individual complaining that what has happened to him is unjust, is simply misconceiving his real relation with the universe. He is a portion of the universe. And insofar as he is a time being, he is the embodiment of all the previous choices of his same protoplasm when it was in the ancestors' bodies. Thus, if Abraham made a certain choice about Isaac, and then later on Isaac breeds and has babies, those babies are a portion of the same protoplasm that was very nearly sacrificed and escaped. So they have a sort of engram pattern in them that when they are being sacrificed, they'll always be around to appear and save them. And this gives them a sort of positivity to the idea of being sacrificed. They believe, when they feel that somebody is trying to sacrifice them, they immediately will sit down and wait for the ram to appear. And they expect that the ram will appear. Now, people that have been sacrificed and no ram has appeared and they have been killed, then they do not breed in the time process immediately, but they lapse from the time process and their energy returns into its original focal center, and then, if it's lucky, it may get back into the time process elsewhere, plus the memory of the fact that when sacrificial knife descends low, it really does descend, and this modifies their behavior. But each time they are presented with an occasion of choice, they are never deficient in the form within themselves that can enable them to solve the presented problem. This means that no being can actually get into a situation that it is unjust for him to be in. This means that when a so-called innocent baby, let's take these Siamese twins that were born recently, and a surgeon separates them, and one dies. Is it unjust that one dies and the other lives? Well, not really, because this particular protoplasm, which became these twins, was obviously needing this separation process in itself, otherwise it wouldn't have joined itself together in this way. There's an excessive stress on the saturnine process. There's too much clinging in the beings that are generating, and they are the same protoplasm that was in the parents, and these parents are the same protoplasm in the grandparents, and so on. The psyche of the one that dies just returns into its prior equilibrium beyond the time process and waits its time for re-entry, plus its own lesson. If we can accept all these things properly, simply as occasions whereby we reassess our own position in relation to the whole, then we are all right, and we can survive any kind of test whatever. But if we pretend that really any single one of these little houses within the big macrocosmic dominion, if we pretend that any one of these houses is separable, separate from the others, and has a vacuum around it, and is independent, then the sense of injustice arises within it, because it cannot account for the peculiar way that it suffers experience. And with the erroneous concept that it is a separate being, evaluating itself from this concept, it will always get into progressively worse trouble. And it must be driven inevitably to the point where it can feel its identity with the very thing it has rejected. Because ultimately, when it separates itself from the rest, it does so egotistically to lift itself above the rest. And directly the end result of that is it must be overthrown by the rest. So that any given individual, whether it's a Hitler or a Mussolini or even a more tolerable fellow like a Churchill, climbing up to a certain level in separating himself from the rest, insofar as he conceives himself to be really separate and triumphing by means of his separativity, by that measure he will be brought down to realize that he is not separate, not separable, and must have a reaction back onto his center from every other portion of the cosmic being. We see then very shortly that no being can in fact be presented with a stimulus situation for which he has not got adequate internal form to respond to. No matter how bad the situation may appear, no matter how much injustice the partial view can see in it, the wider view will always see that precisely this individual, and not another one, has moved inevitably step by step from generation to generation into just that position. Recently there was a case of the digging up an old murder trial again, and the psychologist tried to show that this given murderer had been badly repulsed as a young man by a girl, and tried to show that if this girl had been less obnoxious in the way she got rid of him, he wouldn't have resented it so much as stop killing women later on. Now, if the analysis is true, it simply means that when he started killing ladies and hiding them under the wallpaper and so on, that he was, in fact, simply responding to an energy input from one of the beings of the same order that he was killing. In other words, he has a mental picture of woman as a repulsive thing that pastes you under the wallpaper. And he represses this thing, and then later on he finds himself in a stimulus situation with large supplies of wallpaper and women, and he proceeds to get the brush out and put them under the paper. Now he does this in this analysis quite mechanically, because he has no awareness of his real position. In the purely mechanical sense, this kind of thing does happen. We've had other occasions that we've known about with murder mysteries and so on, where the particular type of the crime has indicated the mental state of the person committing it. And by means of a study of the type of the crime, it has been possible to isolate the characteristics of the murderer and eventually to run him down and find him. Whereupon he, who has really been scapegoated by the persons releasing the forces that force him to do it, now has to pay the price and send back to them the lesson of pursuing him. Because of course if they had any mercy, they wouldn't pursue him in any case. But then if they had any mercy in the first place, he wouldn't have been doing it. So we find that whatever the initial form put into a being immediately conditions the nature of that being's responses, so that the next stimulus coming in must be evaluated over against the first one, or the first one must be suppressed and the new one reacted to as if it were the first. But this is always an occasion of choice. It's a very simple thing, and if we absorb the meaning of it properly, we will never resent anything whatever that happens to us, no matter how bad it may be. And when something horrible does happen to us, we will know that we have wangled ourselves into that position. No matter how many generations it has taken us to get there, it is this very protoplasm which has taken those steps, one by one, that has put us in the position we find ourselves. And therefore, absolutely there is no injustice at all. One of the things raised was whether the gentleman who fell in the sea after doing a bit of orbiting, was it today, whether he had in fact been treated badly. Supposing all the men who were doing the calculations miscalculated, was it an injustice that this man fell in the sea? Supposing he had been drowned, would it have been bad for him to drown? Would it have been wrong for him to drown? Would it be unjust for that volunteer to drown? And the answer is, he couldn't be unjust, because he got into that position. He puts himself in the position. No matter how weak a person is, they can put themselves in a position by choosing. Whether they choose to go under a surgeon's knife, or under electric shocks, or simply under the state of marriage, whatever it is they put themselves under, they will suffer it, because they have actually evaluated their own inner form in a certain way, and this has led them inevitably to be presented with a new occasion of choice. Is that too obscure? Can we say anything more about it?
Does X in this sense, as it were, condition Y, then? X wants having been, as it were, impressed into the being, is the nature of the next stimulus partly its initial form patterns attraction, as it were.
So we have actually said this, except that it is not that the X conditions the Y that's coming in. Let's draw two men. We'll pretend in the big circle is a woman, and there are two men here. This is man number one. He's her first experience. He's what the characterologists would call the picnic type. He's a jolly little fellow, you see, and this woman is characterized by this experience, and he's a very jolly little fellow, and she has, say, 20 years of delightful existence with him, and then he suddenly blows a fuse and dies, as this type tends to do. Now, the next time she's presented with a situation, it might be that the next man is an esthenic type with a very long body and gangly arms hanging down and a long nose. Now, she is presented with an occasion where she will say to herself, oh, either I can say this one isn't like my first one, which I enjoyed, and therefore I reject it. Or she can say, this one is not like the first one I enjoyed. I wonder if it's possible that this one could be enjoyed in another way. The first one could roll about. Perhaps this one can stand up and be run round or something. In other words, the being with the experience is in a position of either seeing it positively as a new opportunity for further characterizing experiences, or it can say, it isn't like the old pattern of my joys, and therefore I'm not going to have it. Now, it is not that the first form, in this case the picnic name, is determining the response to the second one. That isn't so. If that were so, the whole universe would be entirely mechanical. If the first form put in the experience, were the determinant of the attitude to the second form, then all behavior would be purely mechanical, and the word freedom would be meaningless. What actually happens is that when the experience is had, in this case the joyful experience of the picnic type, when this experience is had, all that happens is that the psyche, the being having the experience, chalks up the characteristics on this particular experience. But the will of this being can say to itself, I would like more of this, or it can say, well, maybe I've understood enough of this and I should try another time. And this is entirely within the free choice of the being itself. It is not in any sense mechanically determined by the first stimulus. And we have to be quite clear about this, because if a person believes that it is characterized by the first stimulus, he will suffer from self-hypnosis. He will actually respond mechanically to stimulus situations because he has said to himself, my first experience conditions my second one. So the way we view our experiences, the way we verbalize them, and specifically the way we suggest to ourselves that the response will go, is really simply superimposition of a form of experience by a being upon itself. There is no mechanical determination by the form of experience, quite independently of the will of the being. All the form of the situation can do is record that it was pleasant or unpleasant, and in what way. It cannot of itself force a reaction to the next stimulus. But if the will of the being is very strongly orientated towards that old pattern, it is the will and not the pattern that determines what will be the response to the next situation. I know a woman who's been married 5 times. She's a very positive woman. She wore out 4 husbands, and that was because she was a very strong woman and they were very weak husbands. She has never felt at all guilty about this, although her unmarried sister thinks that she should have felt very, very guilty about it, because she could have used any one of the 4 dead ones. Now, in this kind of situation, the positivity of this much married lady shows itself to be what it should be, namely life unconditioned by its previous experiences. And this is the real message of religion. Whether we talk about Christianity or Buddhism or Taoism, any kind of religion is talking about freedom and how to gain it. And freedom is freedom from something. There is a freeing and there is a doming and there is a self-determination within freedom. And this is the real message of religion. Whether we talk about Christianity or Buddhism or Taoism, any kind of religion is talking about freedom and how to gain it. And freedom is freedom from something. There is a freeing and there is a doming and there is a self-determination within freedom. And what we have to free ourselves from is our past judgments based on our past experiences, so that we can evaluate now in the light of the presented situation, not determined by the past one, so that we are forced either to reject or accept the new one, but to evaluate the new one simply as a new kind of experience. If we like to look at the characterization of ourselves derived from previous experiences and then write a little note about it in relation to the present experience, that is all right. But if we allowed our past experience in any way to condition our present response, we are to that much irreligious in the real sense. Spirit is free. And when Jesus says the spirit blows where it lists, and you can't tell where it goes to or where it came from, he's talking about what the Zen Buddhists call immediacy. You must respond immediately in the present situation to a stimulus. If you allow yourself to be conditioned by your previous experience, it simply means that your previous experience has locked you up, tied you up, and reduced you to a kind of machine. And it has only done this with your consent, because nothing can lock you up unless you will it to do so. If we remember that the word important means what it says, in carrying the letter N becomes M before the labial, P is pronounced on the lips, and the N isn't. So economy says either pronounce the P where the N is, in which case it won't sound like a P at all, or pronounce the N where the P is, in which case it will become an N. It is more economic to say import than to say import, because when you say import, your tongue has to go just behind your teeth. And when you say import, you say it with your lips. So M changes to N before a labial sound. So import, in carry, turns into import. And that is important, into which we carry our will. This means there are no importances whatever in the whole universe, or in any world whatever, other than this simple fact, wills are carrying themselves into the situation. Not very long ago, a woman whose husband died said to me, "I am not going to die, I am going to dig the garden instead. I will now have more time than I used to have to dig the garden." But funny enough, she died very quickly. But she died because she wanted to let her husband know very, very strongly that she was digging in the garden. And it seemed to her that it was terribly important that she should let him know. And so she went. Now, if she had really thought the garden was more important than the husband, she would have stayed to dig. But in fact, she was thinking he was more important than the garden, so she went to find him. Now, this very often happens with people who are related together, closely, emotionally, but it is not a necessity at all. It is simply that the will of A has willed to go to B. And there is no other bondage whatever in the whole universe or in any world whatever other than this. The will creates importances, and it does it by simply willing in, carrying itself in to the situation. So if anybody says, "Are you aware of the importance of this?" one should say, "Who is carrying in his will into this situation?" Because there is no importance other than this. So if you see a notice marked important and an arrow pointing to somewhere, it probably means that the fellow who arranged for the printing of this notice wants you to carry your will into the situation and is giving you a directive. You might think it is not important and write a strange symbol underneath it. If you do so, it will be an index of how important you think something else is. The important thing to realize is that the will is the sole creator of importance. And therefore, there can be no injustice whatever, because the will has willed every step of its own evolution and has retained, by the law of the irritability of its protoplasm, the characterizing forms of its experience. And consequently, when it wills to refer to its experience and to act upon the basis of its experience, it is willing to act like a machine. And it must then mechanically go on calculating what to do next on the basis of what it's already done. But this is bondage, this is slavery. You see this in the simple word of the Indian philosophers, karma. Karma means action reaction, or action on the basis of experience and trying to relate to a present situation in the light of a past situation. It doesn't mean anything else, because this is made, as we need to know, from the word karma, which means love or desire, the Latin cupidity. Karma ruling is karma, which means to say that the records of all the things you have desired inside you, in your protoplasm, these records will determine your activity if you look at them and will to look for something similar. So if in fact one has a series of formal experiences, records them, looks at the form of them, and then looks at the present situation in the light of the past situation, one is willing to behave like a machine. And the whole universe, considered in this way, is called samsara, which simply means the breathing differentiating of a primary seed. In other words, the working out of the logical implications of a prime act. If you work out logically the implications of your acts, you will always act logically. But if you act logically, you will act like a machine. Because logic is a machine, especially Aristotelian logic. If we fabricate another logic called paralogic, or the logic of the illogical, this helps us to get outside the logical machine. And if we remember the argument between the Franciscans and the Dominicans, and the Dominicans thought that logic persuaded God to behave, and the Franciscans said, no, he behaves, and one of the results of his behavior is logic. If this is so, if actually God's will is prior to his reason, then he can will any kinds of logic whatever. And the particular one that Aristotle was fond of, for some weird reason, is only one type of logic, and of all the logics that might be, is certainly the most mechanical, because all it says is that the thing is what it is, which actually doesn't take you much further than you started. If, in fact, you find yourself in any position, no matter what it is, present or unpleasant, if you then look backwards into your experiences and look for similars, and then on the basis of your previous pleasures or pains, you select from the present a given response. Insofar as you do that, you are acting exactly as if you were a machine, and you might as well be one. But if you say, when I look at my past experiences, I can see the inevitability of them developing in that way because I was looking backwards. So that I can see that at 30, I acted just like that because at 20, I had an ambition which I hoped to realize by 21, and it took till 22, 23, 29, and at 30 it wasn't realized. But the inertia of the 20-year-old decision carried on, and I felt impelled foolishly to justify myself, that is to equilibrate myself, by actually fulfilling this most comical, youthful and foolhardy plan that I had fabricated in the dawn of my awakening mind. If this pattern of behavior that is seen at an early stage is willed into, and one then becomes egotistically determined to establish it so that one can witness oneself, one is actually behaving like a machine. But if one reaches a certain level where it is seen that to act in the present in the light of the past is to be entirely mechanical, and that the only way to escape mechanics is to wipe out the whole of the past, including every relation you've ever had with any other being, no matter how personal, how intimate, if it is past, it is past time, and therefore to be utterly transcended, and one's life to be lived now, in the immediate moment. To do that is to be non-mechanical and is to be spiritual. Spirit is precisely this power to see in the present nothing except what is present. So if I look around this room now, and I look and I say, who are these people? I don't know them. And if I were to go unspiritual, I would say, well, last 30, I think they, or some similar forms, were here. That I can start conjuring up in my memory in the irritable protoplasm that I've got names to which I could append the forms here. Now, if I were actually doing that, and it appears at the moment that I am doing it, in so far as I am doing it, I am being mechanical. So that if one of you, while I was rushing to get out, trod upon my toe and hurt it, I might find a little mnemic twinge in the toe and cross that person off as a human being. But to do so would be mechanical. In fact, if I look at you as I actually do look at you, and this is hard to believe for me, I don't know who you are. I've not the faintest idea who you are. There isn't even a vague reminiscence in me unless I deliberately conjure one up. You're entirely new, and because you're new, I'm interested. I'm interested in your viewpoints, I'm interested in your feelings. I want to know exactly what you think about the universe, about yourselves. I don't want to know really what you think about each other, but I want to know what you think about yourself. Because if you tell me about somebody else, you'd be telling me about yourself. So I'd rather get it first hand by you telling me what you think about yourself and save time. If I can keep this entirely new look all the time, to the extent that I know I am being spiritual and I don't know who you are. But in not knowing who you are, I can adjust to you absolutely. And I can inquire out of the depths of your soul, if you're good enough to tell me what's in the depths of your soul, what that is there. And if you're not that good, I can only infer that there must be some dark secret not yet to be revealed. But the essential thing of the spiritual, that is of the free life, is that it literally doesn't have a past at all. It has no reference to time as past. But it says a very peculiar thing. As every event in a now is simply inserted into now at right angles to the so-called timeline, every form is an eternal. Which means that every form in this room is an eternal. Which means that even if I ignore my past, I still know who you are, as to your eternality. But if I go directly, not to your past, but to your eternality, which is either the height or the depth of the soul, according to whether you're standing on your head or your feet, and penetrate to the meaning of that, I'm getting real value, which I am not getting if I try to get into your past. And this is tremendously important. Because it is the key to all proper relation. All real relation is immediate and now and felt and inquiring. It is a quest. The question is its instrument. And it has nothing to do with what has happened in the past. This means if there is a married man in the room and he has a wife, he should actually feel he doesn't know who she is. If he succeeds, he won't be so mad at her. He might even think she's a nice girl. And bring himself into relation with her because he doesn't know her. He might actually find that he can bring himself into relation with her precisely because he doesn't know her, like he used to do when he didn't know her. Whereas, if one believes that one knows any particular person, to the extent that one believes so, there is that much less importance. Because importance is the carrying in of the will. And if you exhaust the meaning of any given being, by carrying your will into it, and then chalk up the record of the experiences, and believe that those experiences, as recorded, constitute that individual, as you have exhausted the meaning of those records, you have no further interest in the individual. Whereas if you can actually tell yourself that you really don't know this person, and that whatever records you have made in the past are simply the records of the observations of an undeveloped being with insufficient data. Then you can relate more fully and more richly in the immediate present. And to do this is the meaning of the word spirit.
Very nice.